Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and today I'm looking for a book to read that uses satire. To help me are my friends Ian and Joe, two English teachers.
My name's Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher, and today, Nick, I think you should read the book Slaughterhouse-Five by Indianapolis writer Kurt Vonnegut, because listen, Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time.
That's a real recommendation right there. I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a book to read that satirizes existing literature, I think you should read, and here's the title, The Most Excellent Comedy and Tragical Romance of Two Gentlemen of Lebowski by Adam Bertacci, who is not from Indianapolis.
Would you like to say a fun little line about it?
No, I think I've used up my intro time with that extremely long title.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
So when you shared the length of your title, I did have to look up how many characters can go in a podcast episode name. It's like 235. That's the max.
I thought you were going to say 2,000, and I was really
no.
Really
there's a specific number. But
who is the? Go ahead.
Did you interrupt me really, and then just say go ahead?
I'm just really curious what the governing body is that sets that 235. Character
Tim,
limit.
Tim
it says
a technological
no more
constraint. Yeah,
maybe 236 on this one is what I'm thinking.
Let's push. Hey, we have to be unique somehow. Let's be.
I can't think of a better way.
One extra.
I can't
character.
Think of any other way. Honestly, this is it. This is our shot, folks.
And then just sit back and wait for sponsors.
Step three: profit.
I don't know what Joe was talking about earlier in his introduction, but I'm assuming we'll find out today.
It's the classic satirical move of Billy Pilgrim becoming unstuck in time.
Do you think, Ian, listen to me.
Yeah, I'm listening.
Do you think Joe is trying to get the leg up on you, elbow his way into going first? It's just going to be starting earlier and earlier. So he's putting it in he's just strong arming his intro. Now he's trying to go first.
Cross my mind.
My name is Joe Holshue, and I'd like to tell you about this book in 1923.
I'm just gonna start. So I am prepared to start.
Wow. It's coming
first.
In hot.
Actually, I don't know if I do want to start this week. I think it might be Ian's week to start.
Yeah, I think that's bullshit.
No.
I think he's...
No,
wait.
We don't do it like that. There are no rules.
Ian, I want you to go first. Plus, hey, I also have another really big announcement.
Oh, boy.
I've read Joe's book, Slaughterhouse-Five.
Excellent. So do I win this podcast? Can we stop recording now?
No, you might lose because of that.
No.
This is a surefire way to make sure we win. Choose a book that Nick has never heard of, so it has this fighting chance.
Joe, you've been winning a lot lately. Plus, I've already read your book, so I'm going to go ahead and declare Ian the winner of this week already. Joe, I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. I understand. But I do have a question. How many books? This is going to sound meaner. This is going to sound meaner than I ask it. How many books have you read? Just like total. Like, so you read Slaughterhouse 5. So that's one. Are there more?
Count them. Slaughterhouse 5. One.
No, hold on. Let me just go to my Audible app. I'm trying to think about the last book I read that was not an Audible book. It was probably Dracula. Okay. Bram Stoker's Dracula.
We have to get sponsored by Audible. We're giving them so much free press.
We're never going to get sponsored by them if we just talk about them every week for free.
Also, why do we need to give these people sponsorships? They're doing it for fun.
All right. I've read 1, 2. Well, How many books is it? Because I think that...
Well, wait, backtrack.
Okay, slow down. How many books is it? Does that technically count as two books or just one?
No, just counts as one.
Just two counts movies. As one.
Was it?
Yeah. Well, it was...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16... Well, actually, no.
16.
Are they in front of you? How are you counting this?
On my Audible app. But like, maybe like 17 books in the past year. That actually sounds like a lot when I say that.
That is
out
loud. So.
It does.
That's so good. Are we saying
like the last calendar year or like since the beginning of the year?
Yeah. The
12 months?
Yeah. You know, give or take.
It's more
probably,
than a book a month.
Yeah, that is not the sort of background that I thought you were coming into this with.
I thought you were an idiot.
I thought it was, I didn't know that nice. You knew how to find books. I thought that's what we were here for.
Do you want to hear more about the Audible app or do we want to do this podcast?
I'm curious. So I guess I do have a follow-up question. Out of the books that you've read in the last year, so whether you listen to them, whether you've read them, what's your favorite? What did you like? What one sticks with you?
Ooh. Okay. This is good. So... I have some books that I liked for different reasons. I think this is tough. I liked as like a world building, like a super in-depth experience, The Stand. That was absolutely incredible.
Did you listen to the entirety of The Stand? It's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, plus the bonus stuff. The good stuff that they cut out on the first time.
They call that part The Sit.
I don't know if we should laugh at that, but and then as far as I would say a book that I felt superior after I read was The Road by Mr. Cormack.
Oh, sure. Yeah. This isn't like light stuff. I mean, those are some pretty heavy hitting books.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Cormac McCarthy, the guy who wrote The Road, you might have missed this in audiobook, but one of the things that he does that is really cool is he never uses quotation marks to separate his dialogue. So when you read it, you think it would be tricky. Like you think it would be hard to follow who is speaking, but he's such a careful, such a crafty writer that when you read it, there's no, like you never get hung up for a second, but wondering who's speaking. It's really, it's impressive when you see it. And he does like 1,000 other things well too, but that's what I always remember about Cormac McCarthy.
I listened to I can't remember what book it was, but it was a science fiction type book recently. And the reader was science fiction great Harlan Ellison. And my goodness, he yelled the whole thing. He yelled the whole book. It was like, rah, rah!
David Lynch does it.
He got it was a Wizard of Earthsea. It was actually really good.
Oh.
It seemed like a full body performance there in the audiobook recording studio.
He wasn't sitting down.
I imagine
he got his full diaphragm in there,
drenched in sweat. He would just like get so into it that by the end he would be panting audibly on the.
It was very.
It was. It took us out. I think I listened to it with my spouse and it took us out of the experience just a little bit.
Ian, can you please tell us about your book At Full Yelling?
Oh, boy. I am enthusiastic about this book, but I don't think I'm going to yell about it. So,
okay.
It is called The Most Excellent Comedy and Tragical Romance of Two Gentlemen of Lebowski. Right from the title, you can tell it's going to be good. As a piece
like
of
most
satire.
Books.
Just like The Fairy Queen.
No, The Fairy Queen's not a great name for that book. Go listen to that episode, folks, and then come back.
That's
here.
Last week.
So this title is ungainly. It is a bit confusing because it's a most excellent comedy and tragical romance, and you don't imagine comedy and tragedy to go together. If you look at the title page, which you can't because this is an audio medium, you'll notice that the word comedy is misspelled. According to our modern standards of spelling, it's spelled C-O-M-E-D-I-E.
Oh, it's like Old English.
It's Old English, exactly. So this long title is at once very Shakespearean and somehow kind of Lebowskian. So the book is takes the story, characters, and aesthetics of The Big Lebowski, the 1998 Coen Brothers film, and presents it as if it were, in fact, a play by Shakespeare. It kind of fits in this minor subgenre, which has emerged in the last 20 years. The most well-known example of this is Ian Desher's, there's like four of them now, five, six. William Shakespeare's Star Wars, which takes the Star Wars story and makes it vaguely Shakespearean.
Was this the first book to do that?
It was around the same time as Desher's William Shakespeare's Star Wars, as a matter of fact. So they kind of emerged around the same time. There's Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which is a different kind of mashup. Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, all kinds of things like that. So this book is kind of seems like a bit of an outlier, but in fact, it's part of this minor subgenre of the satirical mashup.
When did this come out?
Well,
how far after the movie?
Yeah, 2010. So 12 years after the film came out. And apparently, and I can talk, I'm going to talk more later about sort of Bertacci's process for creating this, but it was thought up, it was imagined, drafted, polished, revised, and printed in less than 12 months, in less than a year.
Wow, that's quite a turnaround.
He started turning Lebowski quotes into Shakespeare sounding stuff for fun in like November, and by October of the following year it was published and it was winning awards, and it was like a bunch of the stars of the Big Lebowski have read it and reportedly like it a lot. So like it's really incredibly fast that it would have this kind of turnaround.
I'd like to start by levying an obvious criticism at this, which is
nice.
Which is, you know, like, yeah, it's a quick turnaround, but also obviously it's not original material. Like, he's building on top of something that came before. It's like saying, hey, I wrote my English essay for your class, Dr. DeYoung, really quickly because I copied my neighbor's English essay and changed all of the words.
Yeah, changed it to Old English.
That is a concern. That is a concern that we could level towards Ulysses, taking something that existed before and repurposing it in different form.
It's the premise of the week, so I don't know if that's a fair argument against the book.
Right.
Because, Joe, I got bad news for you. You might have the same criticism for your book.
I want to push back at the idea that taking and repurposing is necessarily copying or lesser. What Bertacci does here is, by adapting, he makes something new. It is not Shakespeare. It is not simply a retread of The Big Lebowski. I just looked up Ian Desher's Star Wars, and those are actually 2013. So that was after this came out. So this is the first, one of the first ones to kind of inaugurate this genre of the Shakespearean geek culture thing. And it is unique. It is different. It is very different from anything I've ever read. We get this a lot where major media properties are referred to as Shakespearean. Things like Breaking Bad.
Give me an example. Okay.
Breaking Bad. Recently, there's a show on HBO, which I'm not watching, called Succession. And everyone says, oh, it's Shakespearean. And these comparisons,
what does that mean?
It's weird. Well, it's weird. They're usually pretty broad-based. Usually, it means it's focused around a central male figure, usually middle age or older, usually white. That character is tragic. There are plots which are convoluted. There are speeches which are dramatic. And so this whole kind of like Shakespearean epithet is applied in this huge range of media properties. And it's kind of strange how this crops up. If you want to say something is high culture and fancy and cool and literary and artistic, the word you use is Shakespearean. So,
which is such a strange word to use, because when we hear something Shakespearean, we think of it as like a mark of quality, obviously, right? Like, if somebody tells you Breaking Bad is Shakespearean, that is a positive thing they're saying about it, right?
Absolutely, right.
But I also feel like the common person's experience with Shakespeare tends not to be a positive one.
It's so true. Well, it's like, it goes back to the idea of the classic, which we've been circling around for several episodes now. The idea that it's something that we know we should read, but it's just so much work to do it. Yeah. So like, if you told someone this is Shakespearean, they might be like, oh, Shakespearean. Huh. But if you ask them, like, let's talk about some Shakespeare, they would run away from that screaming. As someone who teaches Shakespeare, I get this a lot. People running away from my conversations about Shakespeare screaming.
Scream,
the author of this book, of this adaptation, makes this claim weirdly, about The Big Lebowski. He says this is a Shakespearean movie, which is kind of strange because it doesn't fit a lot of that kind of the classic, you know, there's wandering speeches about tragedy. There's not like a central figure who falls.
How are you referring to it in this book? Just so people can understand. So like, are you saying that this book follows like the story principles of Shakespeare, or are you saying it's like literally reads like a Shakespeare story or play or whatever?
Well, a lot of Shakespearean mashups that take X media property and make it in the style of Shakespeare, just make it like a play. Bertacci doesn't stop there. He takes the story, the characters, the linguistic habits, the phraseology, the rhythms of speech, the naming conventions, all of it, and turns it into something which could be recognizably Shakespearean.
All right.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's what Bertacci does, he says, this movie is Shakespearean, and he's right. When you watch a Shakespeare play, you might pick up on the verbal play, the puns, the wordplay, and the same thing shows up in The Big Lebowski, the film. So what Bertacci does is satirize both kind of the cultural Shakespeare fandom and Coen Brothers fandom by emphasizing the places where Shakespeare and the Coen Brothers overlap.
How many bowling scenes are in this?
Quite a few. But in the book, it's not called bowling because they wouldn't call it bowling in Shakespeare's day. They would call it nine pins. So repeatedly, they say that Walter says, he's talking to the knave, which is the dude, the knave. He says, "A pox upon knave, let us play at nine pins," which means...
Ian, I have a question about your book. Is this book funny?
It's hilarious.
Well, there you have it.
Prove it.
It's hilarious.
Prove it.
A lot of the delight in this book is when Bertacci really knows Lebowski well. He knows the story well. He knows the way they talk well. And so certain elements talk good. He's very familiar with that. Certain elements of the classic Lebowski thing remain. So the name Lebowski stays. Walter is Walter. Brandt is Brandt. Some things change just a little bit. So instead of Donnie, we have Donald. Others are completely different. The dude is the knave now, because it's an equivalent, a cultural equivalency. But a chief delight, I think, one of the things that makes me crack up every time I read this is the way that Bertacci takes classic Lebowski lines and moments and makes them Shakespearean, makes them feel like Shakespeare wrote them without
give us an example.
Losing the hilarity. Okay.
All right. You got to give us an example.
Okay. In the classic moment when Walter thinks that the kid, Larry, stole their money and bought a Corvette, he shrieks over and over as he destroys the Corvette. "See what happens, Larry? See what happens? This is what happens, Larry." And in the text, Walter repeats over and over, "Seest thou what happens, Lawrence? Seest thou? Seest thou, Lawrence? This is what doth happen, Lawrence." It's amazing. So it's like just the key elements, the beverage or the verbs, what happens, those stay. But the trappings, the framing is Shakespearean. And it's just like this weird little moment of deciphering. So you're reading this and it seems like when Walter quoth, "A pox upon knave, let us play at nine pins," you're like, "What?" And then you realize he's saying, "F it, dude, let's go bowling."
Yeah.
This kind of thing, this repeated.
Yeah, you got to decide. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it kind of reminds me of last week when we were talking about the fact that you have to be familiar with both these properties to find this interesting.
Right.
Like, you just have to be. It's not, and like, there's no footnotes that's going to substitute for comedy.
You know,
you know what I mean? Like,
well,
there's no
actually,
annotation that's going to be like, "Hey, you know what he meant here? It's very funny. You'll have to watch the movie."
If you don't know Lebowski, it's not going to
work
so well. Go ahead, Joe. Sorry.
Okay. Well, no, my only thought was I disagree. And this is something that came up last week, too. Okay, here's the thing. I think that knowing Lebowski is very important in this, but as long as we're talking Coen Brothers, have you guys seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. So that's an example, Nick, and we didn't talk about this last week, but that's an example of a book that is based heavily influenced by the Odyssey, but you could never know that and still get total enjoyment out of that film, right? So here, like I think here the Big Lebowski, the Two Gentlemen Lebowski, I think this might be slightly different because it is like a direct riff on this. It is like a direct play on this. But here, when we get something that, it's heavily inspired by. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I was going to say, was Brother We're Out There, was that just like a complete response to this book? Because that came out, I think, after this, right? You said this came out in 2000?
No, 2010.
No, this is 2010. I think Our Brother We're Out There was
So Coen Brothers made their own spoof on in this genre.
Like, it's another instance of how this mode, this satirical mode that takes something that everybody knows and plays with it, is everyone's doing it. It's widely popular. And it makes even more sense, I think. And I had forgotten about A Brother Where Art Thou, but it makes even more sense that Bertacci would do this pastiche satire thing to a Coen film when the Coens already do this. The Coens are really invested in these kinds of things. And
now I think the Coen brothers are actually just more brilliant because they did this like 10 years before this book came out. So they spoofed themselves in this, their own stories. And he was like, yeah, I can do a different story from you guys.
The other thing that I think is worth holding on to is that this is not just spoofing. This is not just satirizing the Big Lebowski. It's also poking at Shakespeare, cultural kind of weight of Shakespeare. And this is something. So I think Joe, you said something about, Nick, you said something about footnotes.
You're kind of breaking up.
Yeah, lost you.
Ian, are you there?
Oh, I don't think he is.
Hello?
Well, I'll use this opportunity to start in that case.
now that Ian is done, Joe, can you tell us about your book? I actually just watched Oh Brother, We're Out There.
When we teach the Odyssey, we always finish the Odyssey. Like when the kids are writing their essays, we always put Oh Brother, Where Art Thou with it. Like we let them watch Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. And then we just ask them to like spot the illusion, basically. But it's just like this nice break while they're writing their essays. Sure.
It makes it way more enjoyable.
Oh my God. And every year when we watch that movie, I just love it even more. Like that movie gets better every time you see it. And I can't think of like how often just lines from that film run through my head. I mean, I've also seen it, you know, a dozen times by now, which is more than I've seen most films. But I think of that movie all the time. I did not, however, think of it last week when talking about Ulysses and the Odyssey. And when you guys were like, fuck this, you have to have read the Odyssey to enjoy Ulysses. And I'm like, I don't think that's true. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou would have been a great thing to bring up at that point, which it never crossed my mind.
Hi.
Oh, Ian. Hi, Ian. I can't see not reading the Odyssey or seeing Big Lebowski and having an appreciation for this book or that movie. And this is really it's really a stupid argument.
I don't think it is. I think it's a really interesting argument. I think there's we talked last week about cultural osmosis, and I don't think there's like a toggle switch in people's minds. Either you know something or you don't know it. The thing is that Bertacci talks about he has kind of an afterword. He talks about the value of rereading. So he says, when you watch The Big Lebowski, it makes you want to watch it again. And he says the same thing exists for Shakespeare plays. When you read a good Shakespeare play, there are some bad ones, and those just make you want to tear your eyes out. But when you read a good Shakespeare play and you get it, or you get a little bit of it, you want to look at it again. And I think that's what this book does for me, is it kind of this deciphering that I mentioned. It prompts a sort of rereading, both of the text itself, Two Gentlemen of Lebowski, as well as its source texts. It's a practice of like, yeah, I know To Be or Not to Be. And I see him bring that into the Lebowski universe. And I love the fact that instead of saying To Be or Not to Be Lebowski, he says To Be or Not Lebowski. That is the question. So there's like a little rhyme thing going on there.
Yeah, I mean, it's an inside joke, right? it's an inside joke. It rewards you for being part of the in crowd.
One of the things that I love about this book is how well Bertacci does Shakespeare. So he's not a Shakespeare expert. He's not like a professional Shakespeare scholar. He minored in English, so he doesn't really even have a lot of training in this, but he seems to know and appreciate Shakespeare. And he's so attentive to the little details that he doesn't use the Shakespearean language wrong. And he also deliberately, he worked with Simon & Schuster, who published this, to make the book look like physically, materially, a Shakespeare text. So if you've ever opened a copy of Shakespeare text from the Folger Shakespeare Library, of
what is that?
It's kind of one of the most well-known, frequently used Shakespeare editions for kind of non-specialist educational or casual reading. So if you want to read Shakespeare and you want to understand it, these books are really good for that. And part of what they do is that on the facing page, for each page of play, there is a facing page which has notes. Which has glosses and footnotes that explain confusing parts of the text or clarify certain aspects. And so what Bertacci does in this book is include glosses for his faux Shakespearean text. So he does this in a way that so accurately and adequately mimics, no, not adequately, more than adequately, accurately mimics the conventions of Shakespeare text. That in and of itself cracks me up.
Right.
If you read Shakespeare, you've probably had to look at the bottom of the page or look at the facing page to understand confusing things. Mm-hmm. And so if you replicate that process in reading this text, all of a sudden it's like unlocking a whole new element of the physical material text.
Okay. So I guess when I listen to this,
go for it. Yeah.
When I listen to this, I get like, there's a lot that I get about it, right? Like I understand the mashup. I understand that this is, I would say, like an interesting thing to do, like an interesting experiment, right? Or it's like kind of cool that you can do it. But the phrase that keeps coming to mind for me is just because you can do it doesn't necessarily mean you should do it. The question I keep coming up with is, why does this exist, right? Like what purpose, what niche does this serve? What purpose does this fill?
Ian, do you think you like it so much because you've dedicated half your life to Shakespeare?
And the other half to the Big Lebowski?
No, I think I like it in spite of that. Okay. So I've read a lot. This is a bit of, I'm not going to get into my pet peeve about Shakespeare that much, but once you study something a lot, once you're familiar with it, you can tell cheap knockoffs. You can tell when someone is sort of foolishly in a half-hearted fashion reappropriating elements of this thing that you know and love, and do just not understanding it super well. So I mentioned
hacking it up.
Yeah, I mentioned William Shakespeare's Star Wars earlier, and this does not do it well. This is probably more popular, unfortunately, than the Two Gentlemen of Lebowski, but it's just the Shakespeare part of it isn't as good. Mm-hmm. This text does this thing where we can not just appreciate the pleasurable experience of catching in jokes, catching Easter eggs, chuckling at lines like "I be the walrus, hold thy tongue, Donald." It's not just those delights, but there's also the delight in seeing a clever mind at work, transmuting something, the Big Lebowski, into a genre and mode and medium far, far away. That's a huge act. And I love, as a Shakespeare scholar, I love being able to see that done well. That's a really cool feeling.
But don't you also feel, Ian, like you are in a lot of ways the perfect Venn diagram of this audience? Like we made the joke before of like, do you like this because you devoted half your life to Shakespeare and the other half to the Big Lebowski?
Who cares?
But like, that's like,
who cares?
But like,
it's a fun book. It read good. It good
See,
story.
I understand it's what you're fun. Saying, Joe. I understand what you're saying.
It's comedy.
There is a real benefit to works of media that have depth to them. If you sample just the very surface, it's good. And if you really get into it, it's still good. What I think is remarkable about this is how far expertise can take you into the text. Because the more you study Shakespeare, and probably the better you know the Big Lebowski, not so much in that direction, but the more you...
Which one's harder do you think to understand? The Shakespeare side or the Big Lebowski
text,
side?
I would say I'm not really a good judge because the Shakespeare stuff is like super obvious
tough,
to me.
Tough call, huh? I forgot to ask a pretty important question. How many Shakespeare plays does this like incorporate? This is not just like one all play he riffs on, right?
Works,
it's the entire
catalog.
He
works all of them in. That's one of the things. Yeah, one of the little. So, like I say, like if you know the hits,
slightly impressive,
you'll get the hits.
Yeah.
So can you read us some funny lines and save the best one for last? Because remember, now you have won this.
I protest.
Give us another funny line, then we'll go on.
So there's a classic moment in The Big Lebowski where Jeff Bridges, talking to Mr. Lebowski, says, "Let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me. You know that, or his dudeness, or duder, or El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing." And so this kind of classic moment, El Duderino, Bertacci turns into the following. "Let me not to the marriage of false impressions deny impediments," which, brief time out, that's a reference to Shakespeare's sonnet. "Let me not to the marriage of false impressions deny impediments. I am not Master Lebowski. Thou art Master Lebowski. I am the knave, called the knave, or his knaveness, or mayhap knaver, or mayhap El Knaverino in the manner of the Spaniard, if brevity be not in thy soul or wit. A knave by any other name would abide just as well."
Yeah. Well, fuck it. It's funny.
Yeah.
And it's funny. I don't care. No.
Okay. I was just going to say it is funny. I agree that's funny. And actually, Ian, I think the thing that I'm most impressed by is, like, when you say that this guy has an English minor and he managed to pull this off, you know, like, I mean, we both know the type of person that gets an English major in school, right? Like, it's a person prone to poor decision making. And they aren't.
Oh, boy. Truth to power. No, you're right. You're right. Absolutely.
So, like, when I think of an English minor, I think, like, well, who cares, pal? So I think the number one thing I've taken away from this is your recommendation of saying, hey, this dude did it right. Like, he did it well. Like, he gets the
for
deep
sure.
cuts. Like, it's not just the greatest hits. Like, he is like deep cuts Shakespeare, right? I think that's impressive. And I think that's kind of cool. And for example,
deep cut Shakespeare.
Deep cut Shakespeare. And that last piece that you read, I would have never caught that sonnet reference, but later in that, when he talks about like a name by any other name,
right.
like
yeah.
that's a reference I do get, right? Like to Shakespeare. And that's maybe closer to the greatest hits side, but like I felt rewarded when I caught that. So I do think there's some value here.
Ian, did the deep cut Shakespeare.
That's what they call me. It is possible to do this poorly. And I think Bertacci does it really well and other properties don't do it so well.
So how would like Shakespeare say, Joe, tell us about your book.
"Master Joseph, I see thou hast brought a small tome with thee. Introduce it to us, unfold it upon our waiting nascent interpretations, and let us heed of your contents."
Oh my God, let's never do that again. That was
I love it. And I'm going to do everything good in that mode from now on.
Yeah, by yourself.
At first, when he asked you to do that, I'm like, wow, that's super unfair for Ian. But then when you jumped into it so quickly, I'm like, oh, he fucking loves this, doesn't he? Like, like he does this all the time.
Are you kidding? Yeah. Hey, Ian, I know that every acclaimed author is definitely a weirdo. Do you know any that come to mind?
Yes. J.R.R. Tolkien was not a weirdo. Oh, did you say a weirdo or not a weirdo?
Oh, I said weirdo.
Oh, okay. Wait, so Nick, you say weirdo. How are you defining weirdo? Are we talking like wearing a funny hat, or are we talking about, you know, believing that the earth is flat, or are we talking like more deep-seated oddity or strangeness?
I think all of those things apply. Maybe some sort of dark secrets.
Ooh, dark secrets. Well, basically every author has a dark secret. Some of the dark secrets are pretty boring, like they tried to finish the book, but they couldn't, so they got a ghostwriter. But I think we could do weirdo authors who are particularly weird.
You know what's weird, Ian, is that normally I pick the theme.
Mm-hmm, that
so
is weird.
This is already weird.
Oh my goodness, it's so weird. Perhaps
this
there'll be weird
so
sound effects.
Weird.
We might have a weird
boing.
is that your sound effect?
That was my weird sound effect. Sorry.
Dreadful. I would put that more in the dreadful category than weird, but it's weird how dreadful it is. So I get that going for you.
I have an idea.
Yeah.
I think that's great, but I have an idea.
What?
What if we did a week where you guys brought books written by weirdos?
I just said that. But yes, let's do it. Let's do it. I'll bring a book by the original weirdo himself, Charles Dodgson, aka Lewis Carroll, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. That should be a
That's
pretty
his full name, huh?
Yeah, full-throated full name right there. Last time you'll hear that full name for sure. And Joe, how about you? What are you gonna bring?
I'm gonna bring book.
Full disclosure, Litheads, we're recording
great,
this
Joe.
Without Joe. That's why you've got such one-sided audio, or I guess two-sided audio. But Joe is here in spirit, by which I mean his ghost, or perhaps astral projection, is standing in the corner of my room, pointing at me, and I think clanking some chains. So, I mean, that's already weird right there.
Yeah, and even fuller disclosure, we all record this podcast separately, and we just piece it together.
Very true. Yeah.
We've never actually met.
Really what it is Nick records some lines of dialogue and then I kind of work around those. I riff off of them. It's a very complex. Each episode takes, I would say, 25 to 27 weeks to put together. So
we just don't know of any better way.
I'll go further than that. There is not a better way. This is the best way to podcast, and other people are honestly selling you a cartload full of horse apples. So, Joe, could you just, I don't like you in the corner there. Just move along. He's not leaving. I got to sign off because he's not leaving. He's just being weird.
He's not leaving. That is weird.
How weird. Okay. Weird books next week. That'll be good.
Okay. Bye.
Joe, tell us about the book.
All right.
Or should I?
Nick, yeah, I really hope you just jump in and fact check everything. And those, your facts need not be correct.
No, honestly, I listened to this book twice, back to back.
Why?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was just so dense or if I didn't pick up everything on the first pass or if I was chopping too many vegetables in the kitchen while I was listening to it and I, you know, wasn't paying attention enough, but like I just went back to back and I've never done that with a book before.
Well, I think part of what that comes from, and I'm reading Slaughterhouse-5, of course, by Kurt Vonnegut. Part of what that comes from is I think this book, not unlike The Big Lebowski, is tricky to read the first time that you get through. And it's not difficult, right? Like
it's
any
the time jumps.
Page. Yeah, this book is structured around a series of time jumps. We get Billy Pilgrim in this book, and he is this, when we meet him, a World War II soldier, about 20 years old, at the Battle of the Bulge, at the Battle of the Bulge. And very shortly after this, he becomes, as I said in the intro, unstuck in time. And when he becomes unstuck in time, what happens is through Billy's eyes, I guess through over his shoulder, through the point of view of this narrator, we see him jump around to different areas of his life. And it's jumping around entirely in time. So, for example, we see Billy as a soldier in World War II. We see him post-war. We see him with his late life later as an optometrist. We see his marriage. We see his children. We see him in a zoo on a fictional planet called Trelfalmador. We see him in prison camp. We see him at Dresden. And we see his eventual assassination in this. But all of those pieces happen out of sequence. All of those pieces happen out of time.
And that's not even a spoiler. Because it jumps around so much, right? I mean, it's not like those things that you mentioned, you would think like his death happens at the end of the book. It doesn't, right?
No, it absolutely doesn't. And it's one of the things that's incredibly intentional about this book, right? Like it's an incredibly intentional plot device that Kurt Vonnegut uses. And it's actually a thematic understanding from this book as well. In a lot of ways, I would think Vonnegut would say, you can't spoil this book. Right? Like, I'm going to tell you that Billy Pilgrim is assassinated at the end of his life, and I'm going to tell you that on page 40, right?
Yeah, I don't know what the phrase, poster child for, it's not the journey, it's the destination, or vice versa, rather. It's not the destination, it's the journey.
Vice versa.
Like, is it about, like, not, like, what happens to him, but how does he get there? Is that what you're saying?
I'll take this one, Joe. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus. Yes.
I think this is really unsettling to Joe.
This is great. I want to co-present more books.
And right now I'm marking off my list all of the books that you've mentioned having read. Terrifying.
I mean, Nick, do you really want to take a crack at it? Go for it.
I don't think that would end well.
No, I okay. No, I do not, because I think I'd probably have to listen to it for a third time, but I would enjoy
it. So it sounds like the sort of like de-emphasis of narrative, like the narrative development, the narrative question, what happens, is instead putting emphasis on like how do we get there? Not what happens to William Pilgrim, but how does he end up in this place? What things does he undergo in the process of getting to his assassination? Is that fair to say?
Joe, can I take this one?
So, Billy
Pilgrim. It's a good joke. It's a solid comedy.
I'm thinking yes.
Billy Pilgrim gets at a certain point in this novel, and I'm not going to try to put it in any sort of sequence that makes sense because it doesn't matter what sequence. At a certain point in this novel, he is abducted by aliens and he is brought to a zoo on the planet Trelfalmador. And those aliens, they witness time differently than we do. We, of course, see time as a linear progression, exactly what Ian's talking about, where like your actions have consequences, right? It matters what I do today is going to affect the quality of my life tomorrow. The Trelfalmadorians, they don't witness time like that. In fact, they say that that all time is time, and that for them, observing time is like we might observe a stretch of the Rocky Mountains, that we can see the beginning, we can see the end, we can see all the peaks that happen between. One of the famous quotes that comes from this book, maybe the most famous quote that you see attributed with Kurt Vonnegut, like when you see people talking about him online, so often somebody will chime in and say, do you know?
Billy Pilgrim was unstuck in time.
Oh, no. They'll say, so it goes, right? They'll say, oh, so it goes.
I cannot believe he was the first one to say, so it goes.
Can you believe
it? I cannot believe that.
So that phrase is like a mantra throughout this book. And it's actually a Trelfalmadorian phrase. And when somebody dies, anytime somebody dies, we of course, treat that as this tragic event. But Trelfalmadorians, they say, well, so it goes. Of course he died, but that has no consequence whatsoever. That is of no greater significance than any other moment in his life. It just happens to be this one little peak. So when you ask, like, is the journey more important than the destination here? I think no. I think one of the understandings to come out of this book is that the journey is just as unimportant as the destination.
That's a real good, and real good recommendation for this book.
But I think thematically that gets towards the sorts of things that this book satirizes, because this book does not work as a satire in the same way that Ian's book does. When Ian is talking about the two gentlemen of Lebowski being this meshing of these two properties, these meshing of these two things that we're super familiar with, and building upon that and riffing upon that, one of the things that this book does, this book comes down incredibly critical of war and the incredibly heroic way that we treat death in war, or death in general, the way that we romanticize it, the way that we celebrate it.
Hey, if Joe wins, I want to read a quote that's a poem that's about this. It's my favorite poem of all time. It's Memento Mori, Dulce et Decorum Est. Are you familiar with that, Joe?
I'm not. Is it?
Oh,
is
my
it
gosh,
in Latin?
It's so good. No, it's basically a poem written around towards the end of the First World War, basically doing the same thing. Why do we glorify the horrors of war? Anyway, sorry, go ahead. It's a great poem. I love it. I like this book already.
Yeah, have you read Slaughterhouse-5, Ian?
I have not, because I'm an uncultured Philistine.
Well, and that surprises
Maybe
me.
Maybe I should be an English teacher.
Yeah, you've read all the books. You've got them all. But Slaughterhouse-5 is another book like that in my life, where if I didn't encounter Kurt Vonnegut when I encountered him, I absolutely would not be the person that I am today.
When did him? When was this? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I was...
When he was abducted
a sophomore in high
by
school.
Aliens.
on the planet Trelfalmador.
This guy, Kurt, is like, what are you doing here?
He had a nice van.
So I encountered Kurt.
Is that
Vonnegut.
A joke about the name Vonnegut? Nick, you've got to do better.
No, it was like some guy abducted him in his van.
Darker. Much worse. Much worse.
But Joseph.
Anyway, continue, Joe. Sorry.
Yeah, so I first encountered Kurt Vonnegut at probably the sweet spot when I think you probably should encounter him. And that's when I was a sophomore in high school. We had this guy that worked in our library called Dave, and he didn't do anything. Like, I think he was an intern. We called him Do Nothing Dave, but he knew a couple things about books. This is at our high school library. And I had read Catch 22, and I thought it was funny. Like, I thought it was interesting and funny, and it was a very, like... It
seemed like a cut above.
Yeah, it was a cut above. It was different. And I went to Do Nothing Dave, and I said, hey, I'm looking for a book like this.
Did he know you called him that?
Wait. Did he do anything when you talked to him?
He did nothing.
Well, he closed his web browser.
Whoa.
He closed his web browser, and he said... Have you ever read Vonnegut? They had every book that Kurt Vonnegut had ever written on that shelf. And I grabbed one at random, just totally at random. It actually was not Slaughterhouse-Five. It was a book called Slapstick, which, just a quick side note, Kurt Vonnegut in interviews has said that it's the one book he wishes he hadn't written. He said, he says, if I could have one back, it would be Slapstick. But it was so important to me. And I remember thinking when I read it the first time, I didn't know a book could be like this.
So, Joe, I would just say, for somebody who has no idea like who this person is, or, you know, a complete dullard like Ian who's never read this classic literature, can you give us like everything outside of the book? Like, this was when this book came out, how was it? How did people react to it?
Yeah, so
because I think it's pretty
one
incredible.
Of the things that this set. Yeah, I love it, and it gets back to what this satirizes, right?
Yeah, because you haven't really sold why this is good satire yet.
I have not sold this as satirical.
It sounds like a great book.
It's a great book that, got that Joe wanted to talk about.
So there's an idea surrounding World War II that both of you are going to be instantly familiar with, and that
sounds like a problem.
I doubt it.
That is the fact that when we think of World War II, we think of it in this incredibly romantic way.
How are you using that word? incorrectly?
We think of it as this fight between good and evil, right? Where the Allied powers were clearly on the side of good and the Axis powers were clearly on the side of evil.
Is this where you argue that the Nazis weren't all bad?
No, that's what you have done in the past. No, we think of the Allies as unimpeachably good. We think of the Axis powers as unimpeachably evil. We think of America like riding, you know, the cavalry arriving and us like showing up and saving the day. And World War II ended up being this like, I mean, it's still, I would argue, like the national touchstone that we rally around, which is crazy. I mean, we're approaching 80 years ago, this war ended, right? But it's still this thing that we all have like this tremendous positive feeling for in our heart.
That's not how I phrase World War II.
Okay, yeah. How do you think of it?
Really bad.
Do you?
World War II?
Yeah. Ian, are you on board with this or am I just totally out on a limb?
Okay, no, I think I understand.
I understand what he's saying. You need to articulate this better.
Kind of broadly culturally, yes. This myth of like, maybe it wasn't like, Nick, it wasn't like a good time. But like you see these t-shirts, undefeated in back-to-back world wars. Like,
yeah. Let's verbalize that a little bit better. I think people view World War II as good guys versus bad guys.
I think what maybe Joe's getting at is the dividing line, right? It's very easy to see that in the sort of cultural mythos about World War II, Allied actions were almost always good and Axis actions were almost always bad. And in subsequent wars, I think it's been more difficult to see whether, quote unquote, we are the good guys. To differentiate between like good, morally good actions in war and morally bad actions in war.
I think we're on the same page.
Okay.
I was just getting into semantics.
There's here a way of looking at World War II that I do think romantic is the word I'm going to stick by here, right?
Okay.
It's this feeling of good versus evil, right? And we were clearly on the side of good. But when we see movies like The Dirty Dozen, right? That's also a movie that's just like a cool, fun war movie, right? That is entertaining.
It glorifies
it's almost
war.
A popcorn movie.
It glorifies war.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes. It glorifies war. When this book came out, Kurt Vonnegut, he was a soldier in World War II, and he was a prisoner of war. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge, much like Billy Pilgrim did, and he was captured and kept in a city called Dresden, Dresden, Germany. So Dresden was a non-military target. It was known for, like, it was untouched in World War I. It was a place of museums. It was a place of beautiful architecture. There was no war industry in it whatsoever. The Allies bombed it. Late in the war in Europe, they bombed it, and they did it largely as a morale sinker for the Germans and the Axis powers. They essentially burned it to the ground, and up to 130,000 people, innocent people, lost their lives. Right. So it was this incredible, horrific act of war. You could argue a war crime, right? Like it was this horrific, horrific thing delivered on a civilian target. Well, Kurt Vonnegut was there at the time. Kurt Vonnegut survived the firebombing of Dresden because he was interred in a slaughterhouse, in Slaughterhouse 5, which was about 60 feet below ground, a meat locker in which he and a bunch of other POWs and their German captors essentially rode things out. Vonnegut always had this book in him. Like, he always wanted to write his Dresden book. It was like a goal in his life, right? Like, he's like, this is a story that must be told. Mm-hmm. I see, like, the celebration of war all the time, right? Like, what was the word that you used before?
Glorification. Earlier? Glorification. Like, he came out of this terrible experience and is like, why am I watching movies about, you know, the Duke shooting up people overseas and people are clapping?
Exactly, right? So he sees this glorification of war all the time, and he could never do it. He said, every time I sat down to write about Dresden, the words just wouldn't come. Like, I felt like there was so much to say that all I had to do is just say what I saw, and it didn't come. I couldn't do it. He shows the darker side of war, and he shows not just things like the firebombing of Dresden in here in these little quick snippets, but he shows things like American soldiers not being what you think they are. He shows things like people dying in war in totally non-romantic ways and totally just like embarrassing or anticlimactic ways. And this was, it shot him into international fame. It caught on as an anti-war novel. People loved it. He became a household name. He actually had tremendous guilt over how successful the book became. And he said later in life, in the reissued print, he said, only one person on this planet got any benefit from the firebombing of Dresden. That person is me, he said. Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it?
I mean,
I can see why he would feel guilty about that.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's called one of the greatest anti-war novels ever written, right?
Oh, absolutely.
In the past, I've done books which are largely didactic. I've done a lot of didactic books for this podcast.
Well, and to be clear, when you say didactic, you're talking about books with an overt lesson.
Does it have an obvious ideology?
I think there's an obvious ideology, but I do think there's layers of complexity introduced to that ideology. It's almost like the first time you see Memento or Pulp Fiction, where like the first time you're like, what the fuck was that? Like, what did I just read?
Doesn't sound so far very funny. And maybe that's just presentation, but does satire does satire have to be funny?
So Vonnegut is very frequently described as a dark humorist. And I think that's the way that this is funny. There are not moments in this book where you slap your knee. This is not The Big Lebowski. It's not a Shakespeare play. When we talk about satire, we're looking for things that are that have humor, ironic, exaggeration, or ridicule to expose and criticize stupidity, vice, folly, or something along those lines, right? Abuses, shortcomings.
Your words.
Okay.
Yep.
My words.
Clearly,
right?
Those are things you came up with. Based on your-
but I mean, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about satire. It's like using humor, using irony, using exaggeration to ridicule some injustice in the world or some stupid thing.
So this entire book is narrated by Billy Pilgrim. He's funny. Like, he's funny as he narrates it.
So it's in his presentation, then.
Yeah, it is funny. And I think one of the things that makes Billy Pilgrim funny is I think of it as almost a wry detachment from the situation. He almost feels like an outside observer, right? Like, he almost feels like he's witnessing from this from the outside, even though he is clearly embroiled in it. It's like through Billy Pilgrim's eyes, we as the reader can see these tragic realities. We can see beneath the surface of what's presented. And we see that through the lens of war. We see religion. We see death. We see all of this stuff, right? Like, he wanted to write his Dresden book, right? He sets this novel, like the war parts of this novel are entirely around Dresden and the destruction of Dresden. I think that that is a time in the history of World War II that you cannot think about without realizing, like, oh, that was a pretty shitty thing that we did. Like, 130,000 innocent civilians, 130,000 non-military civilians died when we did that. And they died horrific deaths. Like, they burned to death, right? We did that. Like, the Allied forces, the good guys, the guys that the cavalry like rides in and saves the day, were the ones that did that. Oh, and 3 months later, we dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki. Three months later, we dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, right? Where, like, we did the same trick over again. And you start to think, wow, not just war is bad, but we can behave repulsively in war. Like, the good guys, America, right? Just because it's our team doesn't mean they can't be repulsive.
Yeah. Yikes.
So when we talk about satire, that's what he's satirizing.
The Big Lebowski does do satirical stuff, and therefore the Two Gentlemen does too. But that's much more Horatian. It's much more kind of gentle poking fun. Look, isn't this goofy? It's kind of like your classic New Yorker cartoon. But It sounds like Slaughterhouse-Five, and kind of Mr. Vonnegut's whole thing is that juvenilian satire. It's contemptuous. It's trying to really get on people's nerves and, like, make people feel something strongly, representing outrage or injustice as, like, this extreme, grotesque, parody, ridiculous thing that you can't help but maybe laugh uncomfortably, but still, like, have a strong emotional reaction to. And I wonder whether these two works of satire that we've talked about here today are in these two camps.
I think it's weird that my book and your book this week fall in the same category, right? Like, they seem like totally different things. Like, my book is funny, but it's funny because of the narrator. It's funny because of the observations that he makes, right? Like, the content of my book is not funny, right? So yeah, I mean, I'm totally on board with that interpretation. I don't totally understand what juvenilian is yet. Like, it kind of,
it's like fart jokes.
It's like juvenile.
No, yeah, it's not juvenile. Like, Horatian and juvenilian are both topical. It's just that juvenilian satire is attacking. It's not just like, haha, look at this crazy thing that what's the deal with airline food? It's not that. It's saying,
what is the deal with it, though?
Well, let me give you a list of juvenilian satires.
No,
right? That I think
the very
absolutely
same
wrong.
Wikipedia article. Right?
Yeah, but I'm going to give it to you.
Stop reading Wikipedia.
So my waveform pops up. But when I look at these books out here, when I see Fahrenheit 451, A Clockwork Orange, Black Mirror, right? When I see Lord of the Flies, Catch 22, Brave New World, those are books that absolutely feel like they belong with Slaughterhouse-Five. Like, they feel like they are of the same family. So sure, I think enough, that's absolutely what's going on here.
I've heard your arguments, and I've kind of appreciated the different approaches you've taken. some of you more kind of talking a lot, and others just being much more...
Actually, don't say that, Ian, because I'm going to edit out most of what Joe said. So we say that we talk the same amount. Okay.
You talked the same amount and you said similar things. Yep. So I'm going to just in a completely arbitrary decision, I'm going to award it to Nick because his laugh is slightly less
MVP.
Annoying.
So MVP. MVP.
No. Okay. I'm going to retract that if you're not careful. You watch yourself. This is power. I love how this power feels.
It's a shame because I can't imagine not picking Slaughterhouse-Five as the book that anybody listening to this should read. But
I think you should go with your heart.
But I'm not a liar. And there are rules to this. So Ian, congratulations.
Congratulations on your hollow, hollow victory.
All right, Joe, you lose. Ian, Ian, you had that poem that you wanted to read us, and I did want to hear that. So why don't you take us out and set up whatever you're going to read.
This is a poem which is in honor of Joe's victory today.
No.
There's no meaning anymore. So it goes. This is a poem called Dulce et Decorum Est. It's by Wilfred Owen, and it is not satirical. It's just grim. So this is a poem which does the same anti-war thing that Slaughterhouse-Five does in a somewhat different vein. And this does happen to be my favorite poem of all time. So here we go. I'll try not to weep. Dulce et Decorum Est. Bent double, like old beggars under sacks. Knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs, and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, blood-shod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind. Gas. Gas, quick, boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil's, sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory. The old lie. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. It is sweet and fitting to die for one's country.
That's tough.
Go read Slaughterhouse-Five.
So did I win?
No, Ian won. He
and
read
so
the quote.
It goes.
It goes.
And so it goes.